principle is definitely going to sicken us. There's no way we can get far enough away from war that it does not still stain our hands.
I agree. And it all comes down to each one of us in these times. There are other platforms, I guess, on the internet, according to Coast to Coast, which has been exploring this pretty well at night. George Knapp has.
Oh, how about the ground? How about that for a platform? Let's stand on the ground. There's
a
really good platform.
I agree. But there are other social media locations that are claiming that they will not spy. And so,
please,
in the meantime.
But who's spying on them? I mean, you know.
In the meantime.
We're over time. Can you leave our listeners with one? There we go. We are back into the music. This has been, of course, Cascadia. We had an extended program today. And I want to thank callers. I want to really thank listeners. And I want you to stay in touch with us and tell us what you're actually doing to stand up and, I guess, face off with the powers that be and take it back. Again, KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM. Go to our website. Go to that website. It's the only website you really need. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Inner City Blues Festival on Saturday, April 21st from 5:30 to midnight at the North Portland Eagles Lodge in Portland. For the past 7 years, the Inner City Blues Festival has focused on healing the healthcare blues, supporting Oregon's universal healthcare movement. Performers this year include the Norman Sylvester Review with Sarah Billings and Leanne Miller, the King Louis Payne Quartet and LaRonda Steele, and many, many more. Again, that's the Inner City Blues Festival on Saturday, April 21st from 5:30 to midnight at the North Portland Eagles Lodge, 7611 North Exeter Avenue at Lombard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society April Concert. On Friday, April 20th, the award-winning original roots music group Kathy Boyd and Phoenix Rising will be coming to the Portland Folk Music Society concert stage at 2901 Southeast Steel Street. Doors at 7, concert starts at 7:30. Global Music Awards winner in the categories of lyrics, songwriters, and album for the newest release, 40 Years of Lonesome. Once again, that's Kathy Boyd and Phoenix Rising, Friday, April 20th, Reedwood Friends Church, 2901 Southeast Steel Street, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to The Food Show. I'm your host, Chris Siegel. Near the end of the program, I'll be talking with Nan Devlin, Tourism Director for Tillamook County. Nan is a part of a new initiative called the North Coast Food Trail that highlights the unique and exciting food destinations and experiences in and around Tillamook. I'll also be talking with Marisha Auerbach for our monthly garden segment. As the weather fluctuates this time of year, we're going to be talking about how to monitor temperatures and to make sure that your young plants can grow and produce an abundant harvest. Near the end of the show, I'll also have a special story from the archives. But first, I recently had the opportunity to talk with Bill Kim, owner and chef at Urban Belly, Belly Q, and Belly Shack. He's been widely credited as a pioneer, bringing fine dining to a casual setting. With the help of Chandra Ram, he wrote the cookbook Korean Barbecue, Master Your Grill in 7 Sauces, which just came out yesterday. But his journey up to this point has not been without a struggle. We start off talking about the early years when he and his family first immigrated to the United States. In the introduction to your book, you talk about your experience first coming to the United States, and you describe it as pretty traumatic. You had left friends in Seoul, you didn't speak the language, and you mentioned there were only a couple other Asians at your school. How does your experience growing up in Chicago contribute to the food you make now?
You know, it was very traumatic, and I was the very first one at our grade school that was of a Korean descent. Probably, I think it's the only Asian in that school for maybe 2 years. Obviously, I had my brother to kind of, you know, speak to, but it wasn't like there was a community there. And I don't know if I put in the book that I ditched school the very first day, and the whole entire school were looking for us because I was so afraid to go to school. So we hid in the basement of our rented storefront, and for a couple hours me and my brother were down there. I forced my brother to kind of not to go to school. So that was a big part of us kind of starting our first day at school. And, you know, to my cooking, what became a journey of, hey, I don't want to eat the kimchi or I don't want to eat rice three times a day, what we were accustomed to doing. And I want to quickly transition into being Korean. I wanted to be American fast as I could. So the bologna sandwiches, you know, I had toast in the morning instead of having rice or some kind of a porridge that we would have a lot of time for breakfast. And I wanted to assimilate as fast as I could. And as I got older and started cooking at nice restaurants, I wanted to kind of reminisce of who I became and where I wanted to kind of head. And owning my own restaurant meant to kind of reflecting on who I was as a Korean American, and I wanted to kind of go back to why we came here and who we were as a family, and that's why we opened up like Urban Belly and had communal seating, because it reminded me of us as a family, you know, having me, my brother, and my dad having, you know, dinner at night and having the entire family together. And there was no TV watching during dinner. We kind of caught up on the day and we did that as a family.
And it also sounded like you had some cooking responsibilities when you were young.
Oh yeah. I mean, my parents work, you know, they would wake us up for school and they'll be gone. And one of the things I had to do is wash rice and had it soaking. And right before they came, I would have to turn on the rice cooker and we would have rice. So part of the deal is measuring cups. I don't know if I understood. My mom always said, make sure the water level of the rice is up to your knuckles when you place it gently on top and fill it to your knuckles. So that's how I used to measure rice. Enough water to cook the rice. I never knew what that measurement was, but I always knew it had to go up to the knuckles. So it was I didn't know what I was doing. I knew that was part of my chores that I had to do. So if I didn't make rice, I was in trouble. So I had to make rice.
So you talked about that reflection, kind of the journey to coming back to Korean food, and you write in the book, when I was a young cook, I wanted to cook French food and so pursued jobs with French chefs. I didn't think Korean food was as worthy as French food, but I eventually realized that my food was just as important as French cuisine. Can you talk about that time in your life?
Sure. I think, you know, when I went to culinary school and I decided right after high school that I would go to cooking school, and it was very, very important for me to be legitimate, which meant I need to know the foundation of cooking. So basically I immersed myself to reading this book called Wayne Gisland, Professional Cookery, from page 1 to 128. And I remember this like it was yesterday. And I would study the mother sauces, and our teacher, he was a Hungarian chef, and basically every single day for like the first 6 months would drill you on the mother sauces and the derivative of those things. I'm just like, it was hard in the beginning, then it just became natural, and it just became part of your repertoire, and you're just like, you name off the hollandaise and all the derivatives of those sauces. I'm just like, hey, this is not that difficult. So I wanted the foundation, so nobody could ever ask me like, hey, I know you cook Asian food, but can you do the foundational cooking that most of the cooks that went to culinary school, that they have that? And I was like, no problem. You want me to basically name all the mother sauces? I can do that. And I wanted to be legitimate, which meant I wanted to learn the foundation. Then as I learned the foundation, and again, I stood out in a kitchen because I was looking for, I think all cooks go through this. As you graduate, you want to find the master. You want to find your sensei, or somebody's going to teach you everything about cooking, and you want to work for that person for like 10 years. Well, to my surprise, it was probably 6 different restaurants with 6 or 7 different chefs, and they teach you a little bit about what they know, and you grasp and you put that in your pocket, and you become as a cook by learning their styles and incorporating them. Then I finally decided that what my weakness was, I was almost like an alien when I was young, and I was also an alien in a kitchen where there wasn't a lot of Korean chefs. There were a lot of Japanese chefs, Chinese chefs, but Korean chef back then really wasn't any. So I had to kind of carve my own path, and I worked for a Taiwanese chef named Susanna Fu, and I started asking my mom, like, what are these recipes that you did when I was young? So I started kind of mimicking some of her stuff and learning some of the things from Susanna, and having the traditional foundation of French cuisine, I started thinking about how I want to kind of pursue and do what we do currently.
So that's an amazing experience. It's so interesting that kind of the journey that you went through. And so getting to the cookbook, I'm curious, you took all those experiences, all the culinary school, the, you know, cooking in French inspired American restaurants. It was this sort of whole experience that you kind of embody in the cooking that you do now. And I'm curious, like, how would you describe it? I mean, how is the cookbook? Is it traditional, or is it fusion, or how would you describe this cookbook?
I would say, obviously, it's Korean barbecue, but I think the word fusion, if you want to really break it down, the definition of fusion is two things forced together, joining, and it's fused. So I like to say cooking without borders, which basically means that I could extract, you know, if example, if you look at Thailand and Mexico, right? Both subtropical, same weather, they grow the same elements. And if you look at a water chestnut, for example, it's crispy, it's crunchy, it's starchy. I try to find the similarities in Asian food that I could find in any other culture. And I equate it to Latin cuisine because obviously my wife is Puerto Rican, so that I'm a little biased towards Asian, Latin food. But you look at a jicama and you close your eyes, and if you eat a water chestnut next to a jicama, they are very, very similar. So I try to do that with all foods, find the similarities, and maybe switch. You know, if you look at a sun-dried tomato, you taste the sun-dried tomato, and you taste the Chinese black beans. Very similar way of kind of using the elements of sauteing or chopping up, put in vinaigrettes. It's the same umami, same fermentation. Then you find garum in Italian food, which is a fish sauce, and you also find that in Southeast Asian food. So I try to find the similarities in different cultures and, you know, and use some of the techniques and use some of the ingredients from different parts of the world. And, you know, I'm also biased towards, like, you know, I can't digest dairy, so I'm lactose intolerant. So I try to find things that I could kind of put in our food. So our next iteration of our menu, we're doing a take on Alfredo, but we're using coconut milk and we're using tofu as that creamy flavor that people might like, but it's dairy free. So these are things I think about. It's a little bit selfish because I wanted to be dairy free so I could taste the food, but it's also, can I be take an ingredient that I can't get water chestnuts year round, but I can get jicama year round. So it's the freshness, and it's also having ingredients that's here that emulate some of the Asian techniques or ingredients that I'm looking for.
Yeah, I suppose it would be disingenuous if you were to make a recipe that you couldn't eat yourself. you wouldn't be able to know if it was good or not.
Yes, yes. And you know, I work for a gentleman named Charlie Schroeder, and he basically every single day would drill into my head, you have to taste. When you're done tasting, taste some more. So that was very important. And I get it more than ever now, because I say the same thing to our cooks here.
So you have an interesting idea in your book, and I'm just going to ask you the question that you straight up write in the book. So what does Kung Fu mean when it comes to Korean barbecue?
Well, here's the thing that I think a lot of times, to me, Kung Fu means an art of discipline. People think it's martial arts and all this, and in order for you to be disciplined, you have to achieve a certain level, right? And spend the time, adapt to your environment. And that's what I had to do as an adult. As I grew up, I had to adapt to the environment of, you know, the United States. Then I had to kind of dedicate myself to achieve what I wanted to achieve. And you know, as you grow in the culinary field, you have to get to the next level. And that's what I equated to doing Korean barbecue, where I needed to achieve the foundation and slowly work to that point where my Korean barbecue is different from a traditional barbecue. It's adapting to the situation and arriving here, finding different ingredients and melding the techniques together. And that's what Bruce Lee did. When he finally got to the point when he wanted to do his thing, he didn't do what he was taught. He made his own style. He made a name for himself, and that's what I feel like I'm trying to do.
So I want to dive a little bit into some of the flavors of the book. The full title of the book is Korean Barbecue, Master Your Grill in 7 Sauces. And you were talking about sauces earlier, so it seems like, you know, they're an important aspect of this book. So what is the importance of the sauce in Korean barbecue?
You know, I think, you know, when you're cooking Asian food or Korean food, people are so intimidated by making all these ingredients. And then you got to go buy all the ingredients, because you're not going to have some of the things, Korean chili flakes, or you're not going to have tons of sesame oil. You might have a little bit of soy sauce, but, you know, after you do this one recipe, usually in other books or how you cook, you don't use those ingredients until the next time you want to cook Asian. So it could be months, it could be weeks, it could be days. But with these master sauces, what you do is, it's like the mother sauces in French cuisine. You add and subtract to what you want to do or what you're cooking. So you're using it over and over again. So you're laying the foundation to your cooking. So if you're grilling or you're marinating, you're using these master sauces to be the foundation of your cooking. So that's what was very important for me, to kind of simplify it, kind of demystify Asian food and saying, oh, I need all these ingredients and I could only get these ingredients from this ethnic market that I had to drive 40 minutes to. you could pretty much find a lot of these ingredients at your local supermarket or on Amazon, or you could order it and have it right to your door, and you could start cooking away.
Can you give us an example of one of the sauces?
Sure. I think one of the sauces is a Korean peanut pesto. So if you really kind of dive into a master sauce, right? Example of a pesto in people's mind, it's some kind of herb, some kind of salty, briny element, and you have some kind of oil and a nut. So for me, a salty element could be cheese, like most people think, but a salty element or briny element could be kimchi. Then a herb could be, doesn't have to be basil, it could be a cilantro or mint. A nut in a regular pesto is pine nut. We use a garlic peanut or dry roasted peanuts that you could have. And using olive oil, we use sesame oil. So you blend those flavors together. Now you have something that is completely has the briny, salty, herby element, and you could drop it into a soup or a broth. You could toss that with pasta. You could also put that in a mayonnaise or put that in a hummus. Now it goes in 10 things instead of one recipe. Then you could add, you know, a little bit of olive oil, a little bit of water. Now it becomes a dressing. Or you could take that pesto and rub it over a chicken, let it marinate. Now you could grill a chicken with it. So it's kind of making things very versatile, and it's not one set recipe when you make these master sauces.
For the person who's cooking Korean barbecue for the first time, what are some things that they should keep in mind?
I think, you know, what people think of just barbecue in general, you're told low and slow, take your time. But for Korean barbecue, it's thin pieces of meat that's either pounded or marinated, you know, for a couple hours or overnight, and let the sauces do all the work for you. And instead of being low and slow, it's quick and easy, because a meat that's like a quarter inch thick with a marinade on it is going to cook like 3 to 4 minutes under grill, and you can take it off and you're going to get the smoky. You're not going to get the falling apart tender like you would with a pork butt that's been smoking for about, you know, 16 hours. But there's going to be a little bit of give, but you're going to get salty, earthy, sweet. You might get a little sour. So you're going to get all these elements of different parts of Asia when you bite into like a Korean barbecue skirt steak. Or, you know, you take that same Korean barbecue marinade, put a little yogurt in it, the chicken, it's going to really penetrate, and it's going to have haunting flavors that you're going to be addicted to.
So we're about out of time, but I'm wondering, what are you excited to be cooking right now?
Oh, I'm all into this pasta thing that I'm doing. Well, I call it pasta noodle because I think there's a whole nother world that's we're about to explore, and it's I love eating pasta or noodles, and we're doing what's called the RTC, so red Thai curry bolo with smoked duck, and it's a little fancy, but when it comes down to it, it's a take on spaghetti bolognese, but we do our spin on it, so we're very, very excited about that.
Great. Bill, thank you so much for joining me on the food show.
You're welcome, Chris. Thank you so much.
That was Bill Kim, chef and author of Korean Barbecue, Master Your Grill in 7 Sauces. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. In a moment, we'll have our monthly garden segment with Marisha Auerbach. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel. It's getting close to that time of year when the weather is just right to plant all of the summer vegetables. But it's important to plant smart, or all that hard work and preparation will be for nothing. To help us do just that, I'm joined by Marisha Auerbach. Marisha, welcome to The Food Show.
Thanks, Chris. I'm glad to be here.
So we're on the cusp of the planting season, and it's the fire sale where we start putting everything in the ground. How should we be tracking temperatures, and when will we know for sure it's time to plant warm season crops?
You know, this is a really good question about to ask for this year. Since last year, we had such a cold May. Many people put their tomatoes and peppers in the ground too early, as there are many plant sales in the beginning of May, and our soil temperatures and our air temperatures hadn't quite gotten to where they're warm enough. So what you want to know for tomatoes, they like to have the outdoor air temperature be at least 50 degrees, and that's in the evening. Peppers like it a little warmer than that. Peppers actually want the evening air temperature to be about 60 degrees, and eggplants like it at 60 degrees as well. Now, the trick is that sometimes in our evenings with our maritime climate, we don't even get that in the evenings in the summer. So it's good to pick local varieties and to watch your air temperatures as well as your soil temperatures before you're planting all these warm season crops. And while we're expecting a really great weekend this weekend, I think it's supposed to get up to 70 degrees and it's going to be beautiful, but hold off on any of the warm season crops. And when we're talking about warm season crops, that's, you know, eggplant, tomatoes, peppers, melons, beans, cucumbers. All of these crops are going to want it a lot warmer.
You mentioned local varieties. How can folks find, you know, how would they know that they're local varieties or that they can thrive in our ecosystem?
We have many nurseries in the Portland area that offer heirloom varieties of plants. So you can ask if you're at a nursery where the variety came from, you know, who saved the seed. You know, that we have a lot of really great local seed savers and seed providers in the Willamette Valley. We're actually known for growing seed for this country. So some of my favorite seed companies are Adaptive Seed, Uprising Seed, Siskiyou Seeds, Wild Garden Seeds, all of those seed companies, and will have locally adapted varieties. I'd also include Nichols Seed or Victory Seed Company too.
So I know the list is getting longer and we've got limited time on this show, but what are you planting right now?
Right now, I'm thinking about the root crops and the brassicas. So I like to plant my brassica starts, my brassica plants from starts. And so when I say brassica, I mean broccoli, cabbage, kale, cauliflower. And now is the time to get those in. There's many gardeners that put those in May because they think gardening starts in May, and are disappointed because the broccoli goes straight to flower and it doesn't produce a head. So with those crops, it's very important to plant those in the cool season and give them enough time to be in that temperature that they like best. And then I'm also thinking about the root crops. So I've planted my beets and my I planted radishes. You can plant parsnips and carrots and potatoes, turnips, rutabagas. All of those things can go on in these cool temperatures. And you could probably still plant some peas.
And what's the benefit of planting seeds directly in the ground versus starting them indoors?
Well, some plants prefer to be direct sown. And others, you could do either direct sow or you could transplant, and some you want to do ideally by transplants. So the ones that like to be direct sown are plants that have a difficult time with transplanting, where transplanting will set them back. So all of the root crops, as a general rule of thumb, dislike transplanting because the goal of growing these root crops is to have the roots develop with ease. So they don't want that root disturbance. Some other things that dislike that can go either way is something like corn. Many people do corn by starts. I know up in Orcas Island, they like to do corn by starts because the soil isn't dry enough in time for the corn to go in and to get a full season. Here, I'll direct sow my corn in Portland. I will always direct sow peas and beans because they're large seeds and they don't like transplanting. Something like squash or cucumbers, you can either direct sow or you can do those by a transplant. But you'll notice if you do a direct sown plant next to a transplanted plant that the direct sown plant will catch up to the transplanted plant because of root stress or because of transplanting stress. And then for all those Brassicaceae plants, I like to transplant them just because they're so tasty for slugs. And And if you direct sow them, you might find that you don't get anything. And it's the same thing with lettuce as well. Now, with tomatoes and eggplant and basil and peppers, we need to do those as transplants because we just don't have a long enough time in our season to do those from direct sowing. Of course, people notice that they have tomatoes that come up in their compost pile, and they'll get yield off of those too.
You mentioned the transplant shock. What are ways to kind of acclimate the plants from indoors to outdoors?
Well, you want to do something that's called hardening off, where you'll bring your plants from indoors to outdoors and let them sit outside during the day and then bring them in at night. And you do that for 2 days. And then for the next 2 days, you'll bring them outside and you'll let them sit outside in the evening. So you've got 2 days of them being acclimated to nighttime temperatures as well. And then on the fifth day, you could transplant them in the garden.
So let's say I have a start that's you know, ready to go in the ground. What happens if I let it stay in the pot too long?
You know, it really depends on the plant. So, of course, the ones that I mentioned that you want to direct sow, you don't want to leave those in a pot. You want to make sure that those, you know, you don't want to have those sitting. For something like a tomato, tomatoes actually thrive with transplanting, and they don't mind getting root-bound in the pot. You don't want them to get too far root-bound, but they won't suffer in the same way that broccoli will, which is the other reason why people say that they have a terrible experience growing broccoli is because they get them in six packs, they forget to plant them, and then the broccoli gets root-bound in those little cells, and then it's so stressed that it never produces its roots in the way that is needed to support that head that we like to expect.
So we've talked about tomatoes a few times, and I'm going to come back to them. So what if somebody sees this weekend and they're like, I'm putting my tomatoes out, I'm ready. What happens to the plant if it's planted too early?
The plants will become stunted. They may grow, they might not. It might get too cold. We still could have a frost, or we certainly could have our plants be pelted by hail. If your tomatoes go in too early, they could be stunted in their growth. They might not produce as much tomatoes. They might be more susceptible to pests or disease. And, you know, they get cold. It's like, you know, if they caught a cold, then if we catch a cold, we're more susceptible to catching other things. So, you know, just like if we catch a cold, you know, what you want to do if you plant your tomatoes and it's too early, put a blanket on them. So you can throw a blanket on at night when it's cold outside in the evenings. I have a frost blanket on my tomato starts in the greenhouse right now. It keeps the temperature about 8 degrees warmer. You can put Rime, which doesn't have as much resilience as a frost blanket. It's not as heavy. Or you can cover them with glass. So there's lots of different options of how you can protect them. But we're still, I think it said it was 38 degrees in the greenhouse last night. And so it's a little cold.
So we'll be talking about this again next month.
Yeah, absolutely.
About when to plant.
Hopefully we're not going to get that late cold like we did last year. And we'll be able to get our tomatoes in the beginning of May, like usual.
So this is a big picture question. And I'm sure it depends on the gardener. But at this point, how often should people be working out in their gardens?
You know, that's an interesting question because there's so many variables. How big is the garden? What are people trying to grow? And I think, you know, we should be out in our gardens as long as it makes us feel joyful. You know, gardening should not be a chore. It's something that we get to do to interact with the landscape. You know, I'm out there every moment I can get, but I've been growing food year-round. So if you've overwintered plants, it's great to top-dress them with compost. It's a good time to start spreading the compost so that you can collect more and to be turning the compost piles. When you prepare beds, it's nice to do that 1 to 3 weeks in advance. So that's a good reason to get out this weekend and get those beds ready to go. It's good to check irrigation systems if you've got an irrigation system to make sure it's not clogged or broken in places as we prepare for the heat. So there's lots of stuff that we can do, and there's lots of time between now and then.
Great. Well, last question, Marisha. What do you have coming up? Classes, sales?
Well, my nursery is thriving, and I'm offering lots of vegetable starts as well as medicinal herbs, culinary herbs, berry bushes, all sorts of useful plants. My next plant sale will likely be on Saturday, April 28th. I tend to have plant sales every 2 weeks, and the nursery is also open by appointment. On May 1st, that's Tuesday, May 1st, I'll offer my next workshop in the Grow Your Own Produce workshop series, where we'll focus on warm season crops, edible flowers, and attracting beneficial insects to your garden. And that's at People's Food Co-op from 7 to 9. I do want to give a shout out today to the Earth Day celebration at People's Food Co-op. That's from 2 to 6. And I'll be there hosting a seed exchange as well as a Ask a Gardener booth. So if anyone wants to come by and say hi, let me know that you heard this on KBOO. And another exciting plant sale coming up is on Saturday, May 12th, where I'm partnering with the Home Orchard Society to have a plant sale. So we'll have lots of perennials, and it's a good time to come out and see the Arboretum at the Clackamas Community College and learn about fruit trees. There'll be fruit trees available at that sale as well.
Great. Marisha, thank you so much for your valuable gardening advice and for joining me on the Food Show.
Thanks, Chris. It's always good to be here with you.
That was permaculturist Marisha Auerbach, and you're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. In a moment, I'll be talking with Nan Devlin about the North Coast Food Trail. Stay with us.
True, it's a dance we know the moves. The bow, the dip, the woo. The words are true. The state is old news. Wrap me in your arms. I can't feel it burn.
You're tuned into The Food Show on KBOO. I'm Chris Siegel. When I think of agriculture in Tillamook, a big block of yellow cheese comes to mind. But Tillamook in the north coast of Oregon is a special place with diverse agricultural products, from seafood to dairy products to fresh vegetables. In order to highlight the rich food ecosystem of the north coast, the County of Tillamook and Travel Oregon have teamed up to create the North Coast Food Trail. I'm joined by Nan Devlin, the tourism director for Tillamook County, to talk about that initiative. Nan, thanks for joining me on The Food Show.
Well, thank you for asking me to be on. I'm excited to talk about food.
Great. So I'm going to start off with a big question, and it's going to require a bit of a sales pitch. What is it about the north coast of Oregon that makes it so unique, that makes it a destination?
Well, other than, of course, the beaches and the forests and the rivers and the bays, we have an incredible bounty. Diversified bounty of food, and it comes from rich dairy and farmlands. The terroir out there, the land out there is just perfect for farming. But of course, with the sea and the bay and the rivers there, it's also perfect for fishing and a really wide variety of fish and seafood. And then there are such inventive producers who recognize the quality of the water in the bays or the quality of the air. It is really wonderfully clean air. The people are producing products like they're harvesting salt from Neatarts Bay. They're making beer that is totally dependent upon the quality of air and with wonderful, tasty results. And because of those qualities that makes it wonderful, that makes it terrific for fish and farms to thrive, the area has attracted really talented chefs and breweries and distilleries and wineries that you can't find this food anywhere else.
Yeah, and so Tillamook, when I think of it, you know, I think of cheese. And so what you're describing is this diverse agricultural landscape.
Right. And of course, the cheese is terrific. And there are other cheesemakers there as well, Tillamook being, of course, the largest and the most well-known. And they have really set Tillamook Cheese, the company itself, has set a stage there for entrepreneurship that People say, yeah, you can create this national brand from the small farming community. And I think people take inspiration from that. And some of the quality products that are coming out are now becoming nationally and internationally famous, like Degard Brewing, Pelican Brewing, Jacobson Salt, Pacific Seafood. It's oyster companies that are really getting well known. And it's because of the quality of the land and the air and the water.
So why put together the North Coast Food Trail and Map? Why not just let people come out and explore?
Well, and people can do that. But what hasn't happened before is that information, like which farms can you visit? Where can you find and go and get fresh oysters right out of the water? Where can you get clams right out of the water? Or in the beach. And that was the main thing, is that the information for doing all that was not easily available. And there's another thing too, is that last year this whole thing started, North Coast Food Trail started last year with a two-day workshop. We gathered, along with Travel Oregon, we gathered about 70 people from Lincoln City to Cannon Beach and talked about what can we do to highlight all the wonderful work that all of you are doing. And after 2 days of, you know, seeing this amazing list of farms and breweries and farmers markets that, and restaurants and cooking schools, we had so much to offer that we all decided we need to put this as out as a trail, as a whole experience. And and so that's what we did. It's like, so you can go to the North Coast Food Trail website, you can pick up a map, and you can plan your trip. And these are places that people might not have known existed before. And that's why we've got to share this story.
So it's not just a map of restaurants, and I feel like probably restaurants of all the businesses probably have the most presence. But I want you to tell me, what are the different kinds of food destinations that people can find on the North Coast Food Trail?
Yeah, it is more than just restaurants, and there's also a criteria about the restaurants, and that's that they had to have a predominantly locally sourced menu. And so that's one criteria for them. But there's also like experiences. One of our favorite parts of this trail are all the experiences that you can have. So, for instance, you can go out with the Explore Nature Group. This is a guided series of guided tours that go from March through November. And you can go visit a oyster farm and pluck oysters right from the water and shuck and slurp them right there. You can go out in a kayak and go clamming from your kayak. You can learn to fish with some of the charters, including the dory boats, which launch from the beach in Pacific City. You push the boat out from onto a wave and go out into the ocean, and you come back and full speed ahead onto the sandy beach. I mean, it's a wonderful experience. You can take an eco tour and go foraging in the forest. You can go look for mushrooms. Those are the kinds of things that I think really stand out about this trail. It's not what you'll usually hear and see about are just farm trails. While this includes a lot of farms, it also includes a lot of other enjoyable experiences.
Are you finding that, you know, I mean, I know it hasn't been online for long, but are you finding that people are like, I didn't know this was out there?
Yes. In fact, you know, of course, you know, the North Coast is the easiest place to get to the coast from Portland and Portland metro area. And so people will come out and they'll often do some of the same things. I'm the same way. You come out, you walk on the beach, you might go to a museum, which is wonderful. You might you know, grab some fish and chips somewhere. This is like, this is an opportunity to meet the producers of the foods. It's an opportunity to meet the farmers, the people who are making the salt and the beer. There, it's all really accessible experience. So yes, come out and walk on the beach, or you know, go fishing in the bay, but then stop by and have dinner with the fishermen. You know, you can go out and go crabbing, come back, cook it right there where you caught it, say at Kelly's Marina, and sit down with your family and meet new friends and, you know, have fresh Dungeness crab meal. I mean, there are so many ways to connect with the local culture. You know, one of the things that, you know, we have on the coast is Highway 101, and a lot of times people just get in their cars and they just drive down 101 to a particular destination. This way there are reasons to pull off that road and explore.
So this is a kind of a detail question. You're located in Tillamook, and this is the North Coast Food Trail. I'm curious, how far does it stretch?
Well, so this year, it extends from Cannon Beach through Tillamook County to Lincoln City. We are hoping next year, and we're starting to plan that, that we will extend to Astoria. But this first year, we had a wonderful grant from Travel Oregon to get this started, and the parameters of our grant was Cannon Beach to Lincoln City, with the idea that we would expand to Astoria.
And you mentioned working with Travel Oregon a couple times. Did they come to you, or did you come to them? How did that relationship get created?
Well, Travel Oregon has this terrific program. It's under their Destination Development Division, and they offer what are called rural tourism studios. And some are can be a year long. Others are topic specific, and those are like 2 to 3 day workshops. After getting to know all the producers, the farmers, the beer makers, the cheese makers in Tillamook, I reached out to Travel Oregon and applied for an agritourism focused rural tourism studio, and we were granted that. And so Travel Oregon came to Tillamook. We gathered up about 70 people to start this discussion, and so that was about a year ago, and we spent the next year planning. And then as a part of that World Tourism Studio that Travel Oregon offers, you can also, that qualifies you to apply for a grant to help get your program started. So they have been, and then they helped guide us through the process. And they have been a terrific help to us and a partner all along the way.
Great. And I know this isn't, you know, this hasn't been going for very long at this point, but how are the businesses who are participating, how are they responding so far?
Well, we've been hearing quite a bit. And the very first day that we got the brochures out into all the participants' businesses, we got a call from a restaurant and wine bar, and also it's a seafood market that's in Garibaldi. And they said, guess what? Somebody just came in with a North Coast Food Trail brochure. They had been in Cannon Beach. They wanted fresh oysters, and they drove all the way down here to get them. And it was because of the North Coast Food Trail map. And we had a wonderful launch, an initial launch last Saturday at Pelican Brewing, and we had more than 300 people showed up, and they got to taste the beer and the cheese and the wine and some of the food and other beverages that our farm trail folks are producing. And we got, people came and they stayed. I mean, there were people waiting to get in the door, and they stayed for the whole 4-hour event. It was, and the feedback we got was terrific.
How have you seen agritourism kind of grow and evolve in Tillamook and the surrounding area?
Well, It's actually had, there have been people, individual businesses, individual farms, doing it for a while on their own. And about, what was it, in 2014, Tillamook County passed a countywide, the voters of Tillamook County passed a countywide it's a room tax, a hotel room tax. That money has helped develop a full-scale agritourism program. So it's been a recent countywide effort, but prior to that, it was individuals doing it. And there are some very creative people. There's CS Fishery, which is a sustainable fisheries company, started it about 3 or 4 years ago on their own, going dock-to-table dinners, you know, dock-to-table selling, going right from the fisherman's boat to the restaurants. There have been farms that have been doing that, delivering produce straight from the ground to the restaurants. So it's been going on for a while on an individual basis, but as an organized effort, it's very recent.
And do you see agritourism? I mean, I feel like that area has been production oriented, thinking about the cheese factory and the dairy farms. But is agritourism, is that kind of becoming the identity of the Oregon coast and the North Coast?
Well, you know, it sure can be, and I think that it's going to have a big impact. Agritourism is actually an international trend in tourism. People are seeking, and it's all age groups, by the way, all age groups. They're seeking connections with local culture. They want to know about local foods. And that trend started hitting Oregon several years ago. And what a perfect place, because Oregon has such great bounty and diversified bounty. And of course, I guess you could say wine tourism is also part of agritourism, because you'll go to the vineyards and a tasting room. And that was probably what really kicked off the agritourism effort, was wine tourism.
Nan, we're about out of time, but I have one last question, and that's, you know, you just launched the North Coast Food Trail. You're starting to get feedback about it. What do you hope to accomplish with this initiative?
Well, two things. And one is to really showcase the wonderful bounty that is available to people just not even an hour and a half from Portland. You can come and have be in a great environment, enjoy wonderful food and experiences, and people here really want to highlight their products and get the word out. That's the number one thing. But the second thing, and maybe the whole purpose of, you know, tourism too, is economic development. It is my goal to help these small businesses who put their heart and soul into what they're doing. I really want them to be successful and to grow their businesses, and they can do that while still living in one of the most wonderful places in the world.
Great. And real quick, how can people learn more about the North Coast Food Trail?
So the easiest way is to go to northcoastfoodtrail.com, and you can also go to our Facebook page, North Coast Food Trail. We will be posting regularly there about events and special dinners and highlighting the businesses and telling the stories of everyone involved in the trail. Those are the two best ways. And then we will also have all of the participants and all the visitor centers from Cannon Beach, Lincoln City will have the brochure.
Nan, thank you so much for joining me on the food show.
Oh, thank you. I love telling this story.
That's Nan Devlin, the tourism director for Tillamook County, talking about the North Coast Food Trail. You're listening to the Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. Before we end, I want to return to a story that I featured on the Food Show a few years back. At the time I interviewed Jesus Guillen, he was Oregon's first Mexican head winemaker. Now, he's opening his own winery just outside of Newburgh. In honor of his accomplishment, I want to play the story he told me, recounting his journey of how he became a winemaker.
I was here in Oregon actually studying English, and I was going to stay here until, you know, two terms were due. So, because my goal was to learn English and then return to Mexico, because when with the title of computer systems engineer plus English, you know, you earn a little more money in Mexico. So when the two terms were due, I was kind of deciding if staying here in Oregon or returning to Mexico. So I went just to think about it. You know, I kind of grabbed my car and drove kind of to different wineries, different tasting rooms in the area, kind of knowing new people and kind of mingling with people in different tasting rooms and talking, you know, to them a little bit. But what really caught my attention were two wines in the whole trip. The first wine was the 1999 Arcus Estate Archery Summit. Really powerful, complex wine that made me think I was actually in a forest during the rain. A lot of kind of forest floor notes, you know, kind of leafy, mushroomy underbrush, you know, a lot of different complex notes of earthy tones, kind of black fruit, you know, like black cherry. I forgot I was there for a while, you know, when I was tasting this wine. So it was amazing. So after that experience, basically I went in my car and drove to Adelsheim, you know, kind of like a further away winery. And I chose that just because it was a little further away, so to think about it on the car and everything. But there also the 1999 Elizabeth's Reserve was the best wine on the flight, and also caught my attention in a different way. You know, that one was more elegant, kind of seductive wine, but it had a lot of different notes as well. And very, very powerful structure, but very fine grain, so it hit my palate in a really elegant way. After I swallowed the wine, I could taste it for a long time. You know, so another time is when I was thinking, yeah, maybe I can do this. You know, maybe actually I can stay and somehow, you know, become a winemaker. So it was like a really scary decision because my English wasn't that good and my winemaking skills were basically zero. So it was really, really scary. But when I returned to my home, you know, and told my family about it, they're like, you know, you can do whatever you want here. We're basically in the land of opportunity, you know, and I really believed it to my core. So the next day I developed a plan, you know, that I was gonna follow to become a winemaker. And it happened in 2008.
That was winemaker Jesus Guillen. And that's it for this episode of The Food Show. If you missed any of the show or want to listen back, you can find the episode archived on the KBOO website at kboo.fm. I want to thank our guests, Bill Kim, Nan Devlin, Jesus Guillen, and Marisha Auerbach for being on today's show. I also want to thank Jenka for engineering the show. Stay with KBOO this afternoon, starting with Jazz Lives. And don't forget to tune in again next month on the third Wednesday of May for another episode of The Food Show. Until then, I'm Chris Siegel. Thanks for listening.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away? Cause it ain't the right size or perfect. Cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food. Working those lands for corporations don't do hungry people no good. Cause people need food in their belly. Need some drink for the dying in their throat. For the world.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's time for the KBOO News at noon for Wednesday, April 18th, 2018. In international news, a Palestinian journalist who was shot in the head by Israeli forces last Friday has been moved to a hospital in Ramallah. Ahmed Abu Hussein, a photojournalist from Gaza, was hit with an exploding bullet, a banned type of live fire that explodes on impact, causing severe internal injuries. He's just one of the more than 2,000 Palestinians, including 10 journalists, who have been wounded by Israeli forces firing live fire at demonstrations over the past 2 weeks. On April